This is Audible.
Books on Tape presents Devil in the White City by Eric Larson, read by Scott Brick. Evil's Imminent, a Note. In Chicago at the end of the 19th century, amid the smoke of industry and the clatter of trains, there lived two men, both handsome, both blue-eyed, and both unusually adept at their chosen skills. Each embodied an element of the great dynamic that characterized the rush of America toward the 20th century. One was an architect, the builder of many of America's most important structures, among them the Flatiron Building in New York and Union Station in Washington, D.C. The other was a murderer, one of the most prolific in history and harbinger of an American archetype, the urban serial killer. Although the two never met, at least not formally, their fates were linked by a single, magical event, one largely fallen from modern recollection, but that in its time was considered to possess a transformative power nearly equal to that of the Civil War. In the following pages, I tell the story of these men and this event, but I must insert here a notice. However strange or macabre some of the following incidents may seem, this is not a work of fiction. Anything between quotation marks comes from a letter, memoir, or other written document. The action takes place mostly in Chicago, but I beg readers to forgive me for the occasional lurch across state lines, as when the staunch, grief-struck Detective Geyer enters that last awful cellar. I beg forbearance, too, for the occasional side journey demanded by the story, including excursions into the medical acquisition of corpses and the correct use of Black Prince geraniums in an Olmstedian landscape. Beneath the gore and smoke and loam, this book is about the evanescence of life and why some men choose to fill their brief allotment of time engaging the impossible, others in the manufacture of sorrow. In the end, it is a story of the ineluctable conflict between good and evil, daylight and darkness, the white city and the black. Eric Larson, Seattle. Make no little plans. They have no magic to stir men's blood. Daniel H. Burnham, Director of Works, World's Columbian Exposition, 1893. I was born with the devil in me. I could not help the fact that I was a murderer, no more than the poet can help the inspiration to sing. Dr. H. H. Holmes, Confession, 1896. Prologue. Aboard the Olympic, 1912. Aboard the Olympic. The date was April 14th, 1912. A sinister day in maritime history, but of course the man in Suite 6365, Shelter Deck C, did not yet know it. What he did know was that his foot hurt badly, more than he had expected. He was 65 years old and had become a large man. His hair had turned gray, his mustache nearly white, but his eyes were as blue as ever. Bluer at this instant by proximity to the sea. His foot had forced him to delay the voyage, and now it kept him anchored in his suite while the other first-class passengers, his wife among them, did what he would have loved to do, which is explore the ship's more exotic precincts. The man loved the opulence of the ship, just as he loved Pullman palace cars and giant fireplaces, but his foot problem tempered his enjoyment. He recognized that the systemic malaise that caused it was a consequence, in part, of his own refusal over the years to limit his courtship of the finest wines, foods, and cigars. The pain reminded him daily that his time on the planet was nearing an end. Just before the voyage, he told a friend, "This prolonging of a man's life doesn't interest me when he's done his work and has done it pretty well." The man was Daniel Hudson Burnham, and by now his name was familiar throughout the world. He was an architect and had done his work pretty well in Chicago, New York, Washington, San Francisco, Manila, and many other cities. He and his wife Margaret were sailing to Europe in the company of their daughter and her husband for a grand tour that was to continue through the summer. Burnham had chosen this ship, the RMS Olympic of the White Star Line, because it was new and glamorous and big. At the time he booked passage, the Olympic was the largest vessel in regular service, but just 2 days before his departure, a sister ship, a slightly longer twin, had stolen that rank when it set off on its maiden voyage. The twin, Burnham knew, was at that moment carrying one of his closest friends, the painter Francis Millet, over the same ocean, but in the opposite direction. As the last sunlight of the day entered Burnham's suite, he and Margaret set off for the first-class dining room on the deck below. They took the elevator to spare his foot the torment of the grand stairway, but he did so with reluctance, for he admired the artistry of the iron scrollwork of its balustrades and the immense dome of iron and glass that flushed the ship's core with natural light. His sore foot had placed increasing limitations on his mobility. Only a week earlier he had found himself in the humiliating position of having to ride in a wheelchair through Union Station in Washington, D.C., the station he had designed. The Burnhams dined by themselves in the Olympic's first-class salon, then retired to their suite, and there, for no particular reason, Burnham's thoughts returned to Frank Millet. On impulse, he resolved to send Millet a mid-sea greeting via the Olympic's powerful Marconi wireless. Burnham signaled for a steward. A middle-aged man in knife-edge whites took his message up 3 decks to the Marconi room adjacent to the officer's promenade. He returned a few moments later, the message still in his hand, and told Burnham the operator had refused to accept it. Footsore and irritable, Burnham demanded that the steward return to the wireless room for an explanation. Millet was never far from Burnham's mind, nor was the event that had brought the two of them together. The great Chicago World's Fair of 1893. Millet had been one of Burnham's closest allies in the long, bittersweet struggle to build the fair. Its official name was the World's Columbian Exposition, its official purpose to commemorate the 400th anniversary of Columbus's discovery of America. But under Burnham, its chief builder, it had become something enchanting, known throughout the world as the White City. It had lasted just 6 months, yet during that time its gatekeepers recorded 27.5 million visits, this when the country's total population was 65 million. On its best day, the fair drew over 700,000 visitors. That the fair had occurred at all, however, was something of a miracle. To build it, Burnham confronted a legion of obstacles, any one of which could have, should have, killed it long before opening day. Together, he and his architects conjured a dream city whose grandeur and beauty exceeded anything each singly could have imagined. Visitors wore their best clothes and most somber expressions, as if entering a great cathedral. Some wept at its beauty. They tasted a new snack called Cracker Jack, and a new breakfast food called shredded wheat. Whole villages had been imported from Egypt, Algeria, Dahomey, and other far-flung locales, along with their inhabitants. The streets of Cairo exhibit alone employed nearly 200 Egyptians and contained 25 distinct buildings, including a 1,500-seat theater that introduced America to a new and scandalous form of entertainment. Everything about the fair was exotic and, above all, immense. The fair occupied more than 1 square mile and filled over 200 buildings. A single exhibit hall was large enough to have housed the U.S. Capitol, the Great Pyramid, Winchester Cathedral, Madison Square Garden, and St. Paul's Cathedral, all at the same time. One structure, rejected first as a monstrosity, became the fair's emblem, a machine so huge and terrifying it instantly eclipsed the Tower of Alexander Eiffel that had so wounded America's pride. Never before had so many of history's brightest lights, including Buffalo Bill, Theodore Dreiser, Susan B. Anthony, Jane Addams, Clarence Darrow, George Westinghouse, Thomas Edison, Henry Adams, Archduke Francis Ferdinand, Nikola Tesla, Ignace Paderewski, Philip Armour, Marshall Field, gathered in one place at one time. Richard Harding Davis called the exposition the greatest event in the history of the country since the Civil War. That something magical had occurred in that summer of the World's Fair was beyond doubt, but darkness, too, had touched the fair. Scores of workers had been hurt or killed in building the dream, their families consigned to poverty. There was the fire that killed 15 more, and the assassin who transformed the closing ceremony from what was to have been the century's greatest celebration into a vast funeral. Worse had occurred, although these revelations emerged only slowly. A murderer had moved among the beautiful things Burnham had created. Young women drawn to Chicago by the fair and by the prospect of living on their own had disappeared, last seen at the killer's block-long mansion, a parody of everything architects held dear. It was only after the exposition that Burnham and his colleagues learned of the anguished letters to Chicago's police describing daughters who had come to the city and then fallen silent. The press speculated that scores of fairgoers must have disappeared within the building. Even the street-hardened members of the city's Whitechapel Club, named for the London stalking grounds of Jack the Ripper, were startled by what detectives eventually found inside, and by the fact that such grisly events could have gone undiscovered for so long. The rational explanation laid blame on the forces of change that during this time had convulsed Chicago. Amid so much turmoil, it was understandable that the work of a young and handsome doctor would go unnoticed. As time passed, however, even sober men and women began to think of him in less than rational terms. He described himself as the devil, and contended that his physical shape had begun to alter. Enough strange things began happening to the men who brought him to justice to make his claim seem almost plausible. For the supernaturally inclined, just the death of the jury foreman offered sufficient proof. Burnham's foot ached. The deck thrummed. No matter where you were on the ship, you felt the power of the Olympic's 29 boilers transmitted upward through the strakes of the hull. It was the one constant that told you, even in the staterooms and dining chambers and smoking lounge, despite the lavish effort to make these rooms look as if they had been plucked from the Palace of Versailles or a Jacobean mansion, that you were aboard a ship being propelled far into the bluest reaches of the ocean. Burnham and Millett were among the few builders of the fair still alive. So many others had gone. Olmsted and Codman, McKim, Hunt, Atwood, mysteriously. And that initial loss, which Burnham still found difficult to comprehend. Soon no one would remain, and the fair would cease to exist as a living memory in anyone's brain. Of the key men, who besides Millett was left? Only Lewis Sullivan, embittered, perfumed with alcohol, resenting who knew what, but not above coming by Burnham's office for a loan or to sell some painting or sketch. At least Frank Millett still seemed strong and healthy, and full of the earthy good humor that so enlivened the long nights during the fair's construction. The steward came back. The expression in his eyes had changed. He apologized. He still could not send the message, he said, but at least now he had an explanation. An accident had occurred involving Millett's ship. In fact, he said, the Olympic was at that moment speeding north at maximum velocity to come to her aid, with instructions to receive and care for injured passengers. He knew nothing more. Burnham shifted his leg and winced and waited for more news. He hoped that when the Olympic at last reached the site of the accident, he would find Millet and hear him tell some outrageous story about the voyage. In the peace of his stateroom, Burnham opened his diary. That night, the fair came back to him with extra clarity. Part 1. Frozen Music, Chicago, 1890 to 1891. The Black City. How easy it was to disappear. 1,000 trains a day entered or left Chicago. Many of these trains brought single young women who had never even seen a city, but now hoped to make one of the biggest and toughest their home. Jane Addams, the urban reformer who founded Chicago's Hull House, wrote, "Never before in civilization have such numbers of young girls been suddenly released from the protection of the home and permitted to walk unattended upon the city streets and to work under alien roofs." The women sought work as typewriters, stenographers, seamstresses, and weavers. The men who hired them were, for the most part, moral citizens intent on efficiency and profit. But not always. On March 30th, 1890, an officer of the First National Bank placed a warning in the Help Wanted section of the Chicago Tribune to inform female stenographers of "our growing conviction that no thoroughly honorable businessman who is this side of dotage ever advertises for a lady stenographer who is a blonde, is good-looking, is quite alone in the city, or will transmit her photograph. All such advertisements upon their face bear the marks of vulgarity, nor do we regard it safe for any lady to answer such unseemly utterances." The women walked to work on streets that angled past bars, gambling houses, and bordellos. Vice thrived with official indulgence. The parlors and bedrooms in which honest folk lived were, as now, rather dull places, wrote Ben Hecht, late in his life, trying to explain this persistent trait of old Chicago. It was pleasant in a way to know that outside their windows, the devil was still capering in a flare of brimstone. In an analogy that would prove all too apt, Max Weber likened the city to a human being with his skin removed. Anonymous death came early and often. Each of the 1,000 trains that entered and left the city did so at grade level. You could step from a curb and be killed by the Chicago Limited. Every day, on average, 2 people were destroyed at the city's rail crossings. Their injuries were grotesque. Pedestrians retrieved severed heads. There were other hazards. Streetcars fell from drawbridges. Horses bolted and dragged carriages into crowds. Fires took a dozen lives a day. In describing the fire dead, the term the newspapers most liked to use was roasted. There was diphtheria, typhus, cholera, influenza, and there was murder. In the time of the fair, the rate at which men and women killed each other rose sharply throughout the nation, but especially in Chicago, where police found themselves without the manpower and expertise to manage the volume. In the first 6 months of 1892, the city experienced nearly 800 homicides, 4 a day. Most were prosaic, arising from robbery, argument, and sexual jealousy. Men shot women shot men, and children shot each other by accident. But all this could be understood. Nothing like the Whitechapel killings had occurred. Jack the Ripper's 5 murder spree in 1888 had defied explanation and captivated readers throughout America who believed such things could not happen in their own hometowns. Yet things were changing. Everywhere one looked, the boundary between the moral and the wicked seemed to be degrading. Elizabeth Cady Stanton argued in favor of divorce. Victoria Woodhull advocated free love. A young woman named Borden killed her parents. And in Chicago, a young, handsome doctor stepped from a train, his surgical valise in hand. He entered a world of clamor, smoke, and steam, refulgent with the scents of murdered cattle and pigs. He found it to his liking. The letters came later, from the Sigrans, Williamses, and Smythes, and untold others, addressed to that strange, gloomy castle at 63rd and Wallace, pleading for the whereabouts of daughters and daughters' children. It was so easy to disappear, so easy to deny knowledge, so very easy in the smoke and din to mask that something dark had taken root. This was Chicago, on the eve of the greatest fair in history. The trouble is just begun. On the afternoon of Monday, February 24th, 1890, 2,000 people gathered on the sidewalk and street outside the offices of the Chicago Tribune, as other crowds collected at each of the city's 28 other daily newspapers, and in hotel lobbies, in bars, and at the offices of Western Union and the Postal Telegraph Company. The gathering outside the Tribune included businessmen, clerks, traveling salesmen, stenographers, police officers, and at least one barber. Messenger boys stood ready to bolt as soon as there was news worth reporting. The air was cold. Smoke filled the caverns between buildings and reduced lateral visibility to a few blocks. Now and then police officers cleared a path for one of the city's bright yellow streetcars, called grip cars for the way their operators attached them to an ever-running cable under the street. Drays full of wholesale goods rumbled over the pavers, led by immense horses gusting steam into the murk above. The wait was electric, for Chicago was a prideful place. In every corner of the city, people looked into the faces of shopkeepers, cab drivers, waiters, and bellboys to see whether the news already had come and whether it was good or bad. So far, the year had been a fine one. Chicago's population had topped 1 million for the first time, making the city the second most populous in the nation after New York, although disgruntled residents of Philadelphia, previously in second place, were quick to point out that Chicago had cheated by annexing large expanses of land just in time for the 1890 decadal census. Chicago shrugged the sniping off. Big was big. Success today would dispel, at last, the Eastern perception that Chicago was nothing more than a greedy, hog-slaughtering backwater. Failure would bring humiliation from which the city would not soon recover, given how heartily its leading men had boasted that Chicago would prevail. It was this big talk, not the persistent southwesterly breeze, that prompted New York editor Charles Henry Dana to nickname Chicago the Windy City. In their offices in the top floor of the Rookery, Daniel Burnham, 43, and his partner John Root, newly 40, felt the electricity more keenly than most. They had participated in secret conversations, received certain assurances, and gone so far as to make reconnaissance forays to outlying parts of the city. They were Chicago's leading architects. They had pioneered the erection of tall structures and designed the first building in the country ever to be called a skyscraper. Every year, it seemed, some new building of theirs became the tallest in the world. When they moved into the Rookery at LaSalle and Adams, a gorgeous light-filled structure of Root's design, they saw views of the lake and city that no one but construction workers had seen before. They knew, however, that today's events had the potential to make their success, so far, seem meager. The news would come by telegraph from Washington. The Tribune would get it from one of its own reporters. Its editors, rewrite men, and typesetters would compose extra editions as firemen shoveled coal into the boilers of the paper's steam-driven presses. A clerk would paste each incoming bulletin to a window, face out, for pedestrians to read. Shortly after 4 o'clock, Chicago Standard Railroad time, the Tribune received its first cable. Even Burnham could not say for sure who had been first to propose the idea. It had seemed to rise in many minds at once, the initial intent simply to celebrate the 400th anniversary of Columbus's discovery of the New World by hosting a World's Fair. At first, the idea gained little momentum. Consumed by the great drive toward wealth and power that had begun after the end of the Civil War, America seemed to have scant interest in celebrating its distant past. In 1889, however, the French did something that startled everyone. In Paris on the Champ de Mars, France opened the Exposition Universelle, a World's Fair so big and glamorous, so exotic that visitors came away believing no exposition could surpass it. At the heart of the exposition stood a tower of iron that rose 1,000 feet into the sky, higher by far than any man-made structure on Earth. The tower not only assured the eternal fame of its designer, Alexander Gustave Eiffel, but also offered graphic proof that France had edged out the United States for dominance in the realm of iron and steel, despite the Brooklyn Bridge, the Horseshoe Curve, and other undeniable accomplishments of American engineers. The United States had itself to blame for this perception. In Paris, America made only a half-hearted effort to show off its artistic, industrial, and scientific talent. We shall be ranked among those nations who have shown themselves careless of appearances, wrote the Chicago Tribune's Paris correspondent on May 13, 1889. Other nations, he wrote, had mounted exhibits of dignity and style, while American exhibitors erected a melange of pavilions and kiosks with no artistic guidance and no uniform plan. The result is a sad jumble of shops, booths, and bazaars, often unpleasing in themselves and incongruous when taken together. In contrast, France had done everything it could to ensure that its glory overwhelmed everyone. Other nations are not rivals, the correspondent wrote. They are foils to France, and the poverty of their displays sets off, as it was meant to do, the fullness of France, its richness and its splendor. Even Eiffel's Tower, forecast by wishful Americans to be a monstrosity that would disfigure forever the comely landscape of Paris, turned out to possess unexpected elan, with a sweeping base and tapered shaft that evoked the trail of a skyrocket. This humiliation could not be allowed to stand. America's pride in its growing power and international stature had fanned patriotism to a new intensity. The nation needed an opportunity to top the French, in particular to out-Eiffel Eiffel. Suddenly, the idea of hosting a great exposition to commemorate Columbus's discovery of the New World became irresistible. At first, most people in America believed that if an exposition honoring the deepest roots of the nation were to be held anywhere, the site should be Washington, the nation's capital. Initially, even Chicago's editors agreed. As the notion of an exposition gained shape, however, other cities began to see it as a prize to be coveted, mainly for the stature it would confer, stature being a powerful lure in this age when pride of place ranked second only to pride of blood. Suddenly, New York and St. Louis wanted the fair. Washington laid claim to the honor on grounds it was the center of government, New York because it was the center of everything. No one cared what St. Louis thought, although the city got a wink for pluck. Nowhere was civic pride a more powerful force than in Chicago, where men spoke of the Chicago spirit as if it were a tangible force, and prided themselves on the speed with which they had rebuilt the city after the Great Fire of 1871. They had not merely restored it, they had turned it into the nation's leader in commerce, manufacturing, and architecture. All the city's wealth, however, had failed to shake the widespread perception that Chicago was a secondary city that preferred butchered hogs to Beethoven. New York was the nation's capital of cultural and social refinement, and its leading citizens and newspapers never let Chicago forget it. The exposition, if built right, if it topped Paris, might dispel that sentiment for once and for all. The editors of Chicago's daily newspapers, upon seeing New York enter the contest, began to ask why not Chicago. The Tribune warned that the hawks, buzzards, vultures, and other unclean beasts, creeping, crawling, and flying, of New York are reaching out to get control of the fair. On June 29, 1889, Chicago's Mayor DeWitt C. Krieger announced the appointment of a citizens' committee consisting of 250 of the city's most prominent men. The committee met and passed a resolution. Its closing passage read, "The men who have helped build Chicago want the fair, and having a just and well-sustained claim, they intend to have it." Congress had the final say, however, and now the time for the big vote had come. A Tribune clerk stepped to the window and pasted the first bulletin. The initial ballot put Chicago ahead by a big margin, with 115 votes to New York's 72. St. Louis came next, followed by Washington. One congressman opposed even having a fair, and out of sheer cussedness voted for Cumberland Gap. When the crowd outside the Tribune saw that Chicago led New York by 43 votes, it exploded with cheers, whistles, and applause. Everyone knew, however, that Chicago was still 38 votes shy of the simple majority needed to win the fair. Other ballots followed. Daylight faded to thin broth. The sidewalks filled with men and women leaving work. Typewriters, the women who operated the latest business machines, streamed from the Rookery, the Montauk, and other skyscrapers, wearing under their coats the customary white blouse and long black skirt that so evoked the keys of their Remingtons. Cab drivers cursed and gentled their horses. A lamplighter scuttled along the edges of the crowd, igniting the gas jets atop cast-iron poles. Abruptly, there was color everywhere. Yellow streetcars and the sudden blues of telegraph boys jolting past with satchels full of joy and gloom. Cab drivers lighting the red night lamps at the backs of their hansoms. A large gilded lion crouching before the hat store across the street. In the high buildings above, gas and electric lights bloomed in the dusk like moonflowers. The Tribune clerk again appeared in the newspaper's window, this time with the results of the fifth ballot. "The gloom that fell upon the crowd was heavy and chill," a reporter observed. "New York gained 15 votes, Chicago only 6. The gap between them had narrowed. The barber in the crowd pointed out to everyone in his vicinity that New York's additional votes must have come from congressmen who previously had favored St. Louis. This revelation caused an army lieutenant, Alexander Ross, to proclaim, "Gentlemen, I am prepared to state that any person from St. Louis would rob a church." Another man shouted, "Or poison his wife's dog." This last drew wide agreement. In Washington, the New York contingent, including Chauncey Depew, president of the New York Central and one of the most celebrated orators of the day, sensed a tide change and asked for a recess until the next day. On learning of this request, the crowd outside the Tribune booed and hissed, correctly interpreting the move as an attempt to gain time to lobby for even more votes. The motion was overruled, but the House voted for a brief adjournment. The crowd remained in place. After the seventh ballot, Chicago was only one vote short of a majority. New York had actually lost ground. A stillness settled on the street. Cabs halted. Police ignored the ever longer chains of grip cars that stretched left and right in a great cadmium gash. Passengers disembarked and watched the Tribune window, waiting for the next announcement. The cables thrumming beneath the pavement struck a minor chord of suspense and held it. Soon a different man appeared in the Tribune window. He was tall, thin, and young, and wore a black beard. He looked at the crowd without expression. In one hand he held a paste pot, in the other a brush and a bulletin sheet. He took his time. He set the bulletin on a table, out of sight, but everyone in the crowd could tell what he was doing by the motion of his shoulders. He took his time unscrewing the paste pot. There was something somber in his face, as if he were looking down upon a casket. Methodically, he painted paste onto the bulletin. It took him a good long while to raise it to the window. His expression did not change. He fastened the bulletin to the glass. Burnham waited. His office faced south, as did Roots, to satisfy their craving for natural light, a universal hunger throughout Chicago where gas jets, still the primary source of artificial illumination, did little to pierce the city's perpetual coal smoke dusk. Electric bulbs, often in fixtures that combined gas and electricity, were just beginning to light the newest buildings, but these in a sense added to the problem, for they required basement dynamos driven by coal-fired boilers. As the light faded, gas lights on the streets and in the buildings below caused the smoke to glow a dull yellow. Burnham heard only the hiss of gas from the lamps in his office. That he should be there now, a man of such exalted professional stature in an office so high above the city, would have come as a great and satisfying surprise to his dead father. Daniel Hudson Burnham was born in Henderson, New York, on September 4, 1846, into a family devoted to Swedenborgian principles of obedience, self-subordination, and public service. In 1855, when he was nine, the family moved to Chicago, where his father established a successful wholesale drug business. Burnham was a lackluster student. The records of the old Central show his average scholarship to be frequently as low as 55%, a reporter discovered, and 81% seems the highest he ever reached. He excelled, however, at drawing and sketched constantly. He was 18 when his father sent him east to study with private tutors to prepare him for the entrance exams for Harvard and Yale. The boy proved to have a severe case of test anxiety. "I went to Harvard for examination with two men not as well prepared as I," he said. "Both passed easily, and I flunked, having sat through two or three examinations without being able to write a word." The same happened at Yale. Both schools turned him down. He never forgot it. In the fall of 1867, at 21, he returned to Chicago. He sought work in a field where he might be successful and took a job as a draftsman with the architectural firm of Loring and Jenny. He had found his calling, he wrote in 1868, and told his parents he wanted to become the greatest architect in the city or country. The next year, however, he bolted for Nevada with friends to try his hand at mining gold. He failed. He ran for the Nevada legislature and failed again. He returned to Chicago broke in a cattle car and joined the firm of an architect named L.G. Lorien. Then came October 1871. A cow, a lantern, confusion, and wind. The great Chicago fire took nearly 18,000 buildings and left over 100,000 people homeless. The destruction promised endless work for the city's architects. but Burnham quit. He was 25 years old. He sold plate glass, failed. He became a druggist, quit. There is, he wrote, a family tendency to get tired of doing the same thing very long. Exasperated and worried, Burnham's father in 1872 introduced his son to an architect named Peter White, who admired the young man's skill at drawing and hired him as a draftsman. Burnham was 25. He liked White and liked the work. He liked especially one of White's other draftsmen, a southerner named John Wellborn Root, who was 4 years younger. Born in Lumpkin, Georgia on January 10, 1850, Root was a musical prodigy who could sing before he could talk. During the Civil War, as Atlanta smoldered, Root's father smuggled him to Liverpool, England, aboard a Confederate blockade runner. Root won acceptance into Oxford, but before he could matriculate, the war ended, and his father summoned him back to America, to his new home in New York City, where Root studied civil engineering at New York University and became a draftsman for the architect who later designed St. Patrick's Cathedral. Burnham took to Root immediately. He admired Root's white skin and muscular arms, his stance at the drafting table. They became friends, then partners. They recorded their first income 3 months before the panic of 1873 snuffed the nation's economy. This time Burnham stuck with it. Something about the partnership with Root bolstered him. It filled an absence and played to both men's strengths. They struggled for their own commissions and in the meantime hired themselves out to other more established firms. One day in 1874, a man walked into their office and in a single galvanic moment changed their lives. He wore black, looked ordinary, but in his past there was blood, death, and profit in staggering quantity. He came looking for Root, but Root was out of town. He introduced himself instead to Burnham and gave his name as John B. Sherman. There was no need to amplify the introduction. As superintendent of the Union Stockyards, Sherman ruled an empire of blood that employed 25,000 men, women, and children, and each year slaughtered 14 million animals. Directly and indirectly, nearly one-fifth of Chicago's population depended on the yards for its economic survival. Sherman liked Burnham. He liked his strength, his steady blue gaze, and the confidence with which he conducted the conversation. Sherman commissioned the firm to build him a mansion on Prairie Avenue at 21st Street, among homes owned by other Chicago barons, and where now and then Marshall Field, George Pullman, and Philip Armour could be seen walking to work together, a titanic threesome in black. Root drew a house of three stories with gables and a peaked roof, in red brick, buff sandstone, blue granite, and black slate. Burnham refined the drawings and guided construction. Burnham happened to be standing in the entrance to the house, considering the work, when a young man with a mildly haughty air and an odd strut, not ego here, but a congenital fault, walked up to him and introduced himself, giving his name as Lewis Sullivan. The name meant nothing to Burnham. Not yet. Sullivan and Burnham talked. Sullivan was 18, Burnham 28. He told Sullivan in confidence that he did not expect to remain satisfied doing just houses. "My idea," he said, "is to work up a big business, to handle big things, deal with big businessmen, and to build up a big organization, for you can't handle big things unless you have an organization." John Sherman's daughter Margaret also visited the construction site. She was young, pretty, and blonde, and visited often, using as her excuse the fact that her friend Della Otis lived across the street. Margaret did think the house very fine, But what she admired most was the architect, who seemed so at ease among the cairns of sandstone and timber. It took a while, but Burnham got the point. He asked her to marry him. She said yes. The courtship went smoothly. Then, scandal broke. Burnham's older brother forged checks and wounded their father's wholesale drug business. Daniel immediately went to Margaret's father to break the engagement on grounds the courtship could not continue in the shadow of scandal. Sherman told him he respected Burnham's sense of honor, but rejected his withdrawal. He said quietly, "There is a black sheep in every family." Later, Sherman, a married man, would run off to Europe with the daughter of a friend. Burnham and Margaret married on January 20, 1876. Sherman bought them a house at 43rd Street and Michigan Avenue, near the lake, but more importantly, near the stockyards. He wanted proximity. He liked Burnham and approved of the marriage, but he did not entirely trust the young architect. He thought Burnham drank too much. Sherman's doubts about Burnham's character did not color his respect for his skill as an architect. He commissioned other structures. In his greatest vote of confidence, he asked Burnham en route to build an entry portal for the Union Stockyards that would reflect the yard's growing importance. The result was the stone gate, three arches of Lamont limestone roofed in copper and displaying over the central arch the carved busts, Roots touch, no doubt, of John Sherman's favorite bull, Sherman. The gate became a landmark that endured into the 21st century, long after the last hog crossed to eternity over the great wooden ramp called the Bridge of Sighs. Root also married a daughter of the stockyards. His experience was darker. He designed a house for John Walker, president of the yards, and met Walker's daughter Mary. During their courtship, she became ill with tuberculosis. The disease rapidly gained ground, but Root remained committed to the engagement, even though it was clear to everyone he was marrying a dead woman. The ceremony was held in the house Root designed. A friend, the poet Harriet Monroe, waited with the other guests for the bride to appear on the stairway. Monroe's sister Dora was the sole bridesmaid. "A long wait frightened us," Harriet Monroe said, "but at last the bride, on her father's arm, appeared like a white ghost at the halfway landing, and slowly, oh, so hesitatingly, dragging her heavy satin train, stepped down the wide stairway and across the floor to the bay window, which was gay with flowers and vines. The effect was weirdly sad. Root's bride was thin and pale and could only whisper her vows. Her gaiety, Harriet Monroe wrote, seemed like jewels on a skull." Within 6 weeks, Mary Walker Root was dead. 2 years later, Root married the bridesmaid, Dora Monroe, and very likely broke her poet sister's heart. That Harriet Monroe also loved Root seems beyond dispute. She lived nearby and often visited the couple in their Astor Place home. In 1896, she published a biography of Root that would have made an angel blush. Later, in her memoir, A Poet's Life, she described Root's marriage to her sister as being so completely happy that my own dreams of happiness, confirmed by that example, demanded as fortunate a fulfillment and could accept nothing less. But Harriet never found its equal and devoted her life instead to poetry, eventually founding Poetry Magazine, where she helped launch Ezra Pound toward national prominence. Root and Burnham prospered. A cascade of work flowed to their firm, partly because Root managed to solve a puzzle that had bedeviled Chicago builders ever since the city's founding. By solving it, he helped the city become the birthplace of skyscrapers, despite terrain that could not have been less suited to the role. In the 1880s, Chicago experienced explosive growth that propelled land values to levels no one could have imagined, especially within the downtown loop, named for the turnaround loops of streetcar lines. As land values rose, landowners sought ways of improving the return on their investments. The sky beckoned. The most fundamental obstacle to height was man's capacity to walk stairs, especially after the kinds of meals men ate in the 19th century. But this obstacle had been removed by the advent of the elevator and, equally important, by Elisha Graves Otis's invention of a safety mechanism for halting an elevator in freefall. Other barriers remained, however, the most elemental of which was the bedeviling character of Chicago's soil, which prompted one engineer to describe the challenge of laying foundations in Chicago as probably not equaled for perverseness anywhere in the world. Bedrock lay 125 feet below grade, too deep for workers to reach with any degree of economy or safety using the construction methods available in the 1880s. Between this and the surface was a mixture of sand and clay, so saturated with water that engineers called it gumbo. It compressed under the weight of even modest structures and drove architects, as a matter of routine, to design their buildings with sidewalks that intersected the first story 4 inches above grade, in the hope that when the building settled and dragged the sidewalks down with it, the walks would be level. There were only 2 known ways to resolve the soil problem. Build short and avoid the issue, or drive caissons down to bedrock. The latter technique required that workers excavate deep shafts, shore the walls, and pump each so full of air that the resulting high pressure held water at bay, a process notorious for causing deadly cases of the bends and used mainly by bridge builders who had no other choice. John Augustus Roebling used caissons famously in building the Brooklyn Bridge, but their first use in the United States occurred earlier, from 1869 through 1874, when James B. Eads built a bridge over the Mississippi at St. Louis. Eads discovered that workers began experiencing the bends at 60 feet below ground, roughly half the depth to which a Chicago caisson would have to descend. Of the 352 men who worked on the bridge's notorious East caisson, pressure-related illness killed 12, left 2 crippled for life, and injured 66 others, a casualty rate of over 20%. But Chicago's landowners wanted profits, and at the city's center, profit meant height. In 1881, a Massachusetts inventor, Peter Chardon Brooks III, commissioned Burnham and Root to build the tallest office building yet constructed in Chicago, which he planned to call the Montauk. Previously, he had brought them their first big downtown commission, the 7-story Granice Block. In that structure, Burnham said, our originality began to show. It was a wonder. Everybody went to see it, and the town was proud of it. They moved their offices into its top floor. A potentially fatal move, as it happens, but no one knew it at the time. Brooks wanted the new building to be 50% taller, if, Brooks said, the earth can support it. The partners quickly grew frustrated with Brooks. He was picky and frugal and seemed not to care how the building looked as long as it was functional. He issued instructions that anticipated by many years Lewis Sullivan's famous admonition that form must follow function. The building throughout is to be for use and not for ornament, Brooks wrote. Its beauty will be in its all adaptation to its use. Nothing was to project from its face, no gargoyles, no pedimenta, for projections collected dirt. He wanted all pipes left in the open. This covering up of pipes is all a mistake. They should be exposed everywhere, if necessary, painted well and handsomely. His frugal glare extended to the building's bathrooms. Root's design called for cabinets under sinks. Brooks objected. A cabinet made a good receptacle for dirt, Mice, too. The trickiest part of the Montauk was its foundation. Initially, Root planned to employ a technique that Chicago architects had used since 1873 to support buildings of ordinary stature. Workers would erect pyramids of stone on the basement slab. The broad bottom of each pyramid spread the load and reduced settlement. The narrow top supported load-bearing columns. To hold up 10 stories of stone and brick, however, the pyramids would have to be immense, the basement transformed into a Giza of stone. Brooks objected. He wanted the basement free for the boilers and dynamo. The solution when Root first struck it must have seemed too simple to be real. He envisioned digging down to the first reasonably firm layer of clay, known as hardpan, and there spreading a pad of concrete nearly 2 feet thick. On top of this, workers would set down a layer of steel rails stretching from one end of the pad to the other, and over this, a second layer at right angles. Succeeding layers would be arranged the same way. Once complete, this grillage of steel would be filled and covered with Portland cement to produce a broad, rigid raft which Root called a floating foundation. What he was proposing, in effect, was a stratum of artificial bedrock that also would serve as the floor of the basement. Brooks liked it. Once built, the Montauk was so novel, so tall, it defied description by conventional means. No one knows who coined the term, but it fit, and the Montauk became the first building to be called a skyscraper. What Chartres was to the Gothic Cathedral, wrote Thomas Talmadge, a Chicago architect and critic, the Montauk Block was to the high commercial building. This was the heyday of architectural invention. Elevators got faster and safer. Glassmakers became adept at turning out ever larger sheets of plate glass. William Jenney of the firm Loring and Jenney, where Burnham started his architectural career, designed the first building to have a load-bearing metal frame in which the burden of supporting the structure was shifted from the exterior walls to a skeleton of iron and steel. Burnham and Root realized that Jenney's innovation freed builders from the last physical constraints on altitude. They employed it to build taller and taller buildings, cities in the sky inhabited by a new race of businessmen, whom some called cliff dwellers. These were men, wrote Lincoln Steffens, who will not have an office unless it is up where the air is cool and fresh, the outlook broad and beautiful, and where there is silence in the heart of business. Burnham and Root became rich men. Not Pullman rich, not rich enough to be counted among the first rank of society alongside Potter Palmer or Philip Armour, or to have their wives' gowns described in the city's newspapers, but rich beyond anything either man had expected. Enough so that each year Burnham bought a barrel of fine Madeira and aged it by shipping it twice around the world on slow freighters. As their firm prospered, the character of each partner began to emerge and clarify. Burnham was a talented artist and architect in his own right, but his greatest strength lay in his ability to win clients and execute the elegant designs of Root. Burnham was handsome, tall, and strong, with vivid blue eyes, all of which drew clients and friends to him the way a lens gathers light. Daniel Hudson Burnham was one of the handsomest men I ever saw, said Paul Sterrett, later to lead construction of the Empire State Building. He joined Burnham and Root in 1888 as an all-purpose helper. It was easy to see how he got commissions. His very bearing and looks were half the battle. He had only to assert the most commonplace thing, and it sounded important and convincing. Sterrett recalled being moved by Burnham's frequent admonition, "Make no little plans. They have no magic to stir men's blood." Burnham understood that Root was the firm's artistic engine. He believed Root possessed a genius for envisioning a structure quickly in its entirety. I've never seen anyone like him in this respect, Burnham said. He would grow abstracted and silent, and a faraway look would come into his eyes, and the building was there before him, every stone. At the same time, he knew Root had little interest in the business side of architecture and in sowing the relationships at the Chicago Club and Union League that eventually led to commissions.